say, Joe Stroud would call up and say, Tony, I got a job interview with Lee Iacocca. I'd like to have you do the interview with us. So I do that. All those that they wanted me to go on or any special assignment that come up, they come back and say, look, you need some pictures of Henry Ford. And we can't get a hold of Henry Ford. You know him. So I call Henry Ford and get back. One interesting thing that came, when Henry Ford married Christina, let me show you, knowing these people, knowing how you report photographically, honesty and truth and pictures, comes back to you. Henry called me from New York. He says, Tony, I know everybody wants pictures of me and Christina. I want you to take a picture of us two. We arrive at the airport at Metro in the Ford hangar. He said, we arrive there, I want you to be the only photographer. Could you take a picture of us two? I know you do a fine job. And give them to the other newspapers and wire service. I says, fine. So I came in there, and I was the only one shot the pictures. We ran the pictures that evening in the paper. I offered them to the news. I offered them to the wire services, like he said, and it worked out very well. And came out such a good friend with Henry Ford. He trusted me quite a bit. And I had access with him real good. Even newspapers and magazines would call me and wanted me to go ahead and get pictures of Henry Ford and different things, which worked out very well. And
was one of the reasons why you were so highly regarded and trusted, not only because of the quality of your work, but your judgment in what you selected?
I selected. In other words, I didn't want them to look ugly, whatever.
Right.
People sometimes report a picture out of context, you know, a person is talking and expresses, well, the idea of twitching their ear or rubbing their nose.
Yeah.
These are not pictures I want. It's a natural thing, a person, but you run a picture like that and people get a different opinion of a person. You're not capturing his real self, his real personality. See, I did that with anyone. I don't care who he was, a prisoner or anything else. I want a nice picture,
right.
That's it. I don't want to take any ugly pictures of people. They knew this.
Right.
That's why Henry trusted me so much, like I said earlier, I did. He wanted me to do Edsel Ford's wedding pictures,
right.
And did the whole thing for him, too. Well, all these would come in very handy. Very sad that when he died and passed away, I was personally invited to attend his funeral. I got a special invitation here at home, came personal, that wanted me to be one of the persons at his funeral. So these things come back. But all the people that I knew in industry, in private life, and all the ones that were connected, even with universities and even with doctors, it's your reputation. You live by your reputation and your honesty. You know, all through the years, you did photograph many different type peoples. You know, you had the rich and the real wealthy and the very poor, the good people, the bad people, you know, the sad and the happy, and all type peoples and all types of white presidents, kings. You know, you learn a lot from these people through the experience, from them. I really learned the meaning of good photojournalism, the meaning of life, what they have. You learn from all your different experiences and all walks of life. This is what makes a good photojournalism. They say, well, you learn that a lot from all these different assignments you've covered, and all these come to you every time you're photographing somebody.
I wonder if this isn't a good time to take a break.
Okay.
Tony.
Best
Lions.
Love Michigan football. Covered every game.
Okay, we're all set.
All set. Tony, when you started in 1946 with the Free Press, there were two other major newspapers in Detroit. to say the least of which, they were all in competition with each other. How did this competition affect your work as a photographer or photojournalist?
Very effective, very much. Let me tell you why. Detroit Times and Detroit News were afternoon newspapers. Free Press was a morning newspaper. Before we started off in the morning, I had to look at the Times, what they ran, their pictures, and what the news ran, so I know what to cover. It was a very, very competitive thing for the journalistic. The reason for it, if there was an assignment, say, that happened in the morning, a news job, one in the afternoon, all three newspapers would be there. They would shoot. We had to make sure, I tell the staff, don't shoot what the news and Times are using. They're going to come out that afternoon. Try to get a different angle or different type pictures, because we would be coming out that night, which would be in the following days, happen on Tuesday. We would come out in Wednesday's paper. They would come out that afternoon on the same day. So it was very competitive for us, more than the other papers. It would also happen with them when it was a late afternoon job. We would come out that evening, and they would come back the following day. So how to overcome this? Every morning early, I'd make sure that I'd see news and Times. I'd go through all our pages, see what they covered. If we had to cover something that afternoon, make sure we come up with something different. And if we covered the same job that they had, and they had a better picture, I'd post those pictures up on our bulletin board every day. Call a photographer, how come, why did you miss this particular picture? How come you didn't get something? Why do you have the same type picture they have? Couldn't you move and get something different? In other words, we would critique the papers, not to criticize the photographers, but to put them aware that any time there are three newspapers that don't go along with the pack, try to get something different, because we are the only morning newspaper. And you got to come up with a different approach, different type picture. So this is what we stressed, and it worked. I mean, but you had to be on it all the time to make sure they would see the newspapers. They would take a look at the Times when you get the first issue right away in the morning delivered to us. I remember Neil Schein would come and deliver the paper in days. I said, bring that paper on time. Yeah, yes, sir, yes,
Neil
sir.
Neil was your assistant at that time, is that
no,
right?
No, Neil was a copy boy.
Copy boy, all right, yeah.
Copy boy. The copy boy's job was the time they get both papers, News and Times. They had to deliver a copy to each department. And I said, well, you bring ours here first, because I got to look at the pictures. And he did that very well. And that was very important to do it. It was very competitive. It was very interesting, too. I think it put photographers, photojournalists, more for creative ideas to come up with better type pictures, because you had competition. Competition makes you a better photographer. It has to.
At what point did television media come into the...
Well, television really came in, I'd say, it started coming in 1950. It really came a little earlier. But they started getting news photographers, you know, mm-hmm. to come back and cover news. They had their regular cameras. They would pan, everything else. Panning was a great thing in those days for them to cover the action. But with us, when we know that TV was covering, we had to make sure to capture that precise moment, the action where it happened, not the whole thing, not before or after. That's what made a good photojournalist, getting that precise moment, capturing that in one still photograph, what it really meant. That was our job, and this is what we had to do best.
Is this competition still as intense now in the 1990s as it was?
No. There really isn't that much competition now. You have today the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. You got TV. Most of the things, TV covers things. They all cover the same things. We sort of like to move on the side to get a different angle. But it's not anymore as competitive We get along very well with the TV photographers. They could set up lights or different things. Early days, we used to push around. They used to be in our way. We'd be in front. But today, they're all on one side. We're on one side. We get along very well with the photographers today.
In addition to politics and special events, you also covered sports during your career.
I love sports. I covered a lot of sports. I covered a lot of baseball and football. Mm-hmm. I covered hockey and basketball, but I love really football and baseball. I covered a lot of hockey also, but mainly football and baseball. Baseball was very interesting. I'd always look for the different approach. One picture I could tell you in baseball was very interesting. It was in 1955. It was a 12th inning at that time, Briggs Stadium. Yogi Berra hit a home run and won the baseball game. All the other photographers, he was going to come around. They didn't like to shoot home base pictures, you know. But I stayed there, stayed up there, because I get Joe Ginsberg was on his knees all the way through. And here comes Yogi Berra, crossed the plate, winning the game, two catchers, one losing, one winning. But it showed you the grief of the catcher on his knees, the umpire just looking, you know, sad, and Yogi Berra coming in. And that's when he came after the reporters interviewed him after the game. That's when he got the first slogan. He said, "Well, it ain't over till it's over." That's where Yogi Berra started. These are things that you remember, key pictures that are in Baseball Hall of Fame and used quite frequently.
Did you have a favorite manager on the Tigers that you enjoyed working with?
Bucky Harris was good. He was very fine. I liked Bucky Harris. All the rest of them were in between managers, but Sparky Anderson is a colorful person, a wonderful man, good coach, but managers never interfered too much. But one day, it was when you had to take pictures sometimes of managers, you know, and you had to get their permission sometimes. Sometimes you didn't have to get their permission that you had to work with. But you look for certain things. In the early, this was in 1948, and the speed graphic camera, and I wandered and I saw a guy sitting, Mr. Baseball, you know.
Yeah, Connie Mack.
I heard the term Mr. Baseball. Here he's sitting in the stands,
yeah,
all alone in his regular time. So I ran up, took a picture of him, straw hat on, everything else. He stayed there, looked at him. No one else photographed him, but I did. Come back. That was brought back to the paper. That's like a Connie Mack, a manager of the Philadelphia Athletics. And he ran at the whole back page, him sitting in the stand, Mr. Baseball. See, these are things sometimes you see. If you get that feeling to photograph something, you go do it. Don't argue with yourself. Take the picture, it's more important. But it amazed me to see him sitting in the stands that became very important. Managers then were quite a number, New York managers, all Tiger managers, I got to know them very well, and they knew you on the field. But also, they're the World Series, I covered the World Series. The other one I like is Brock. In 1968 World Series, here is the Tigers were losing all the games at that time. Brock is a they hit a play way out to Willie Horton, way on center field. Brock is on third base, thinking, well, he'll run home, not knowing the strong arm of Willie Horton. He threw one straight pitch right down to Bill Freehand, who was the home plate. But Brock kept running, you know, as well. Right near the end, he realized it, but he came in, and Freehand, a big guy, stopped him. Boom. 1 inch, out by 1 inch, stopped him from the plate. Now, if he would have slid in, he would have been safe. He talks about it every time coming in. What a stupid thing. He said he didn't slide into home base.
And he caught that.
Got him going to two together.
Right.
Freehand stopping him. His foot 1 inch away from the plate. And he was out. Matter of fact, umpires at the time debated on a decision, but then they made the decision he was out. The following day, I brought a print. They were playing again and showed him where he was out. And we ran, of course, the sequence in the paper of him being out at home plate. But these are plays to capture that precise moment I was talking earlier. You have to anticipate the action, too, when you cover sports. You have to figure what's going to happen. See, when you want to get something, want to get a batter at home plate, if you want to get, a good picture of her, say, if get at the bat, you want to hit a home, if Seth Fielder had to, I want to get a picture of Fielder hitting in good action. You got to know when to shoot it. As soon as he throws the thing, you have, because that delay, the bat is swinging fast. If you hear the crack at a bat, picture is gone by the time you get it. Say, so you got to know that precise moment how to cover action sports. It takes a little time to anticipate this action. In the old days when we had the speed graphic camera, or we had the big Bertha that we covered up on top, was a 28-inch at the Brick Stadium, Tiger Stadium. We up on top, the long lens was a 5x7 holder. Had one chance, so you had to know when to trip that shutter to get the action. It was a little delay, you know, when you come back and get it. So you know how to get that precise moment. You had one shot at those days. This is how important it was to be experienced in the speed graphic camera to transition to 35. We won't shoot as many pictures with a 35-millimeter cameras, those that had the experience with 4x5, because normally we still wait for the precise moment. Today, those that never had the experience of 4x5 speed graphic will have a motor drive and just click away, see, and get that. But starting clicking away, you got to know when to start to click, because you could miss that precise moment too. But that, you could tell the experienced photographer. I could come back from an assignment from a baseball game, maybe have 3 rolls of film. The other photographer would have 12 or 14, because he wasn't experienced with the 4x5 speed graphic. I was very selective. Covered what I thought was an important part of the assignment. This is the experience. But doesn't make any difference, I think. The photographers today do shoot, overshoot a little bit, but overshooting is a good idea, at least to have what newspapers want to use in a newspaper.
Now, you also covered football, and you also covered Michigan football.
I love Michigan football. That was my favorite place to go. Mm-hmm. I covered every Michigan football game. With all the coaches, I traveled with the team. Mm-hmm. It was on Saturday. Even though I worked, started Monday, I'd go on Saturday. We had to make a schedule. I'd take 3 other photographers and myself to cover the football game. I would be up shooting the overheads with a long-range camera, follow the plays. We had 2 photographers on the ground, and 1 for features in a stand, because we had a lot of deadline. We'd run 8 pages of pictures of football. Football was a great sport for us at the Free Press. We covered a lot of football. I love covering football.
What? How did a photographer capture turning points in games, and how important?
Well, they would ask that. You would see sometimes a sports person would run on a key thing why they lost the game or why they won the play that won the game. This is what they call a turning point of the game. First thing you ask for, what about that interception pass? You have it. See, oh yes, I have it. If you didn't have it, that's okay too. You can get something else to play with, supplement that. But it'd be a great thing if you had the turning point of the game, the pass or the interception, they would give that a big play. If you didn't have it, that's fine. I mean, you know, they won't hold you down for it. But it's always good to know the play of the game, how the game is going. If it's a tie game, keep your eye on that ball. Make sure you get the play that's going to win or lose, or the interception or the fumble near the end of the game. And that is a very stressful thing to think of, photographer. You miss it, you feel terrible if you missed a shot. But you got to know, get meaningful plays. Mm-hmm.
You've also indicated in one of your accounts how important it is to keep an eye on not only the camera and the lens, but also on what's going around.
Well, whenever I cover, reason why I use two eyes in taking pictures in a service and gunnery practice, we had to keep both eyes open, and I got so used to that that to me in covering sports, I like to keep both eyes open, because if you have your camera here, you look into the viewfinder, this other eye gives you the action coming towards you. So you would be very careful. If you squint, you're blind, see? In other words, I could frame my picture with two eyes, and I could see the action. This is where accidents happen on the field, where you see some photographers are hit by players, football players, because they're squinting, they don't know what's coming at them. See, in other words, I would know, I'd see someone coming, I'd move way before anything would come back towards me. So in all the pictures I take, and most of them, I keep both eyes open. I got so used to it than anything. I think I could frame my picture better. I can move the action, more people, one left or right. It becomes a way you train yourself in shooting pictures.
You also must have been in touch with some of the great Michigan coaches during the period of your career.
Oh, yes, very well.
Fritz Kreisler,
Benny Osterbahn, Bo Schembechler, yeah. All of them very, very good. Mm-hmm. One picture that I thought I remember, I could tell you this. I was up on top, shooting down, covering Ohio State and Michigan. Being a journalist, photojournalist, I know what the word 30 means. You know, it means the end of the story. You know, 30, when a reporter would end their story, they put 30 on. That means it was all through. There was nothing else coming. So during the heat of the game, Woody Hayes was the Ohio State coach. See, he was signaling somebody, and he walked on the field a little bit at number 30, standing number 30. So I saw that, and I shot him on 30, figure 30. He lost the game there. We ran that picture real big, Woody Hayes, 30. You know, he lost the game, he was signaling. So I sent Woody Hayes a print of that because 30. He liked it. He thought it was very humorous, very good. You know, that's how colorful of a person he was. But these are things you remember in sports. You also look for things that are always happening. You keep your eye on the coaches, you keep your eye on the players, what's happening on the field. You don't have time. I'm always keeping your eyes on what's happening on the field, because something could go on that could be important, like this one picture of Woody Hayes.
Right. Thanksgiving Day was another favorite of yours, and you covered that for many, many years in Detroit.
Well, I covered every parade since 1946, every Thanksgiving Day. It became sort of a tradition with me. being not being home for Thanksgiving dinner. The only way I get home be in the evening, but I was never in a morning to go ahead and spend a day home on Thanksgiving Day. Because it also, my wife Frances, that is a tradition. If I don't go to the parade, there won't be Thanksgiving. And I've covered all of them. We did a calendar for a benefit for the parade about 6 years ago. All the pictures I had taken during the parade, I've taken them. In 1984, Dave Lawrence, who is one of my favorite editors, started this Distinguished Clown Corps. We would take a picture of the Corps and give them a print. Each one would donate $1,000 to be a Distinguished Clown towards the Thanksgiving Day Parade. Today, there's 110. It started with about 32. There's 110 people that belong to the Distinguished Clown Corps that I take their group shot before the parade, and each one gets 11 by 14 color print. We still do that today, give each one of them for the contribution towards the Thanksgiving Day Parade. They've also, in that end, they've made me an honorary Distinguished Clown. So I carry a little pin, and it's quite a thing. It's quite a tradition. These are all composed of civic leaders in a city. You have Joe Hudson, that's a Ford, Linda Kuhn, all the people that belong to this group that they have. But there's quite a number of people in there that have all distinguished and civic leaders contribute this $1,000 for the parade. And they look forward to it, to wait for me to take the group shot. We take it in front of Cobo Hall. I remember the days when the Thanksgiving Day Parade used to be down Woodward Avenue. The J.L. Hudson Company used to be the marquee. Santa Claus would come up on the marquee. The parade would end at Grand Circus Park right there. And 100,000 people would crowd up in front of Hudson's, where Santa Claus would be given the key to city by the mayor, and all these people be in front. It was a great thing. The parade now goes, starts at Mack, and it goes all the way down to end of Jefferson Avenue. But I think it's still missing that high thing where the people would, Santa Claus would be with the key, where all people would be around them and see him with the key to the city. It was something that I miss, I think. The parade is good, but I think it was great when it was on the marquee at Hudson's, or if they could figure some place where Santa Claus could be there and all the people could come crowd and see, all the people could see Santa Claus get the key to the city.
That was Tony, in your career, that which is international in scope in many ways, you started in Europe in the war, in the peace treaty and on the USS Missouri in the Pacific Theater. You've been back to Europe many times, to Italy to visit with the Pope. What other events in Europe have you covered?
Well, I covered the wedding of Princess Margaret also. And that was an interesting thing. Let me tell you what happened away. That's when Princess Margaret married Armstrong Jones. So you had to get clearance with Scotland Yard and all the people we have. So I want to get in Westminster Abbey because they were preparing the ceremonies, wedding was going to take place at Westminster Abbey. So I walked around outside Westminster Abbey. I had a camera on my neck, just took one camera because, and it was a back door. The back door was open, see, with electricians and technicians and other people were working. So I walked in, looked around, no one stopped me. And I took pictures inside, people doing things, the altar where the chairs were, where they were going to get married, how the preparation was. No pictures were allowed in Westminster Abbey till the day of the wedding. Nobody was allowed. So I walked around there and everything else and took all the shots and what they were doing and how it looked, you know. It was the day before the wedding, how it looked and everything else. The deacon came up to me, says, "Are you with the crew?" I said, "No." I says, "I'm just looking here." He says, "Well, you're not supposed to be in here." I says, "I'm not." I said, "Oh, no." He said, "You can't be in here." Well, I had taken all the pictures. I had a camera on my neck. He didn't say anything to me. So I walked out. See, so I had all these pictures. So I went back, and right away, I put them in packets, got me airport, flew them back. Got that evening. It was the morning. Arrived that evening by Pan Am to the Free Press. Got them on the phone. I told them I got pictures of the inside of Westminster Abbey. That no pictures were allowed. I just walked in and took them. Right away, we ran two pages of pictures on them. AP printed them and transmitted them. While I was in London, I saw it in the London newspaper, the picture, the day of the wedding, how the Abbey looked. See, so this was quite an accomplishment, but just happened to walk in and casually and took the pictures and came out. But if the deacon would have asked me, you can't have pictures in a camera, you know, it's forbidden. I would have been very truthful as well. Look, I did take pictures.